lot of members good morning. I see a warranty sense between the chair and the rest of the delegation. It's a warranty sense. But it's fine. Welcome, honorable members. I see maybe other colleagues are still on the way, but I do have an apology from honorable Yenin, who is not well this morning. And that's the only apology that I have. Am I right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mano Kalabro? Sometimes I'm here in Parliament. If you say 120 Plain Street or 90 Plain Street, I get confused. Which one is 120? Which one is 90? I'm sure with other colleagues it's the same as well. It's difficult to. But I'm happy everyone is here. Honourable members, so we take this opportunity now to welcome the Financial and Fiscal Commission, FFC. I have also received an apology from the acting chairperson. He said that someone else must act. Acting today, the delegation of the FSC today is led by Mr. Ajam. Welcome, Commissioner, and welcome to your delegation. And welcome also National Treasury, represented by Ms. Fano. Honourable members, today we will take the presentation by FFC. This is a very important presentation because it makes preparation for the recommendations for the Division of Revenue of 2013-2014. So it's very important that we understand it. The Constitution enjoins FFC to make recommendations to Parliament 10 months before the presentation of the before the tabling of the budget. So that is the process that they are in. The Money Bills Procedure and Related Matters Act also says amongst our responsibility as the Standing Committee on Appropriation is to take recommendations of FSC. I was discussing with the chairperson or acting chairperson in terms of how can we elevate this discussion? In fact, from last year, I think there has been a lot of interest in that the House chairperson Frolic has taken a lot of interest inviting FFC to present to the committee of chairpersons. And it's been very interesting because different committees like energy, like COPTA, they have taken a lot of interest. on the recommendations. I guess with current recommendations, I'm sure the committee like environmental affairs as well will also take interest. But the presentation we had last week, if I'm correct, it was last week, it was a short presentation because it was on a Friday. It's just that the chairpersons are currently busy, the committees are currently busy. We would have loved to invite them so that they could take the process with us. But the issue that I was saying about elevating is how to manage. I think that what we have not yet mastered as a committee is how to manage this process. Maybe the discussion that we could have might not necessarily be today is when we make these recommendations to Parliament, then on the other hand, running parallel to this, it's other processes of national treasury with different departments and the provinces in terms of preparing for the budget of the following year. Now, how do we ensure that this process feeds into that process? I think that is a big question that faces us. Because, as you know, as appropriation, I think our role is just to coordinate, to ensure that these recommendations are taken into account, are taken seriously by Parliament. But I don't know how the portfolio committees relate to provincial committees, to local government in terms of this. I know, or we do know, that FFC does present to the provincial government, I guess, with local government. But I think it would be a good idea if all of us, there was some kind of coordination, you know. But we have not mastered that kind of coordination. But with those few words, feel welcome. And if I may invite you at this stage to address us with your delegation. Some faces are familiar, not all the faces are familiar.
So let me reiterate the apologies of our acting chair, Bongani Khumalo, who is unfortunately overseas. And then to introduce myself, I think I've met many of you before. My name is Tanya Ajam. I'm a commissioner with the Finance and Fiscal Commission. Let me introduce my delegation. On my far right is Dr. Mkululi Ngube. Then we have Henry Exton, with whom I'm sure you're very familiar, our parliamentary officer. On my left, Dr. Ramos Mabogo. Then our researchers, Sasha Peters and Nomonde Madibola. Okay, as you know, the submission is made in terms of the Constitution, the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, and the Moneyball Amendment Act. So what I want to do is, before my colleagues go and speak to the detail, I just want to give the committee a big picture of what we're trying to achieve, because we put so many recommendations and so much research at one time that it's actually very easy to kind of lose yourself in the discussion.
I'm sorry, Ms. Ajam. You know, I need to apologize to FSC profusely and to and maybe we will have to do it in writing. You know, the act, and a colleague raised it during our discussion for the appropriation bill which we passed. It requires that, the Constitution requires that we consult with FFC. You know, we have had so many consultations with FFC, to the extent that sometimes we forgot what it is that we consulted over and not consulted and not cut together. And I think that this year we didn't speak to you about appropriation. We had discussions about the division of revenue, but not appropriation. I think that I would like to apologize to you for that, and it's something that we should have done in terms of it's a requirement of the Constitution. Sorry.
Thanks for that, Chair. I think that I would also ask our parliamentary liaison officers to perhaps be more proactive in terms of initiating these discussions well in advance, so that if it's a lapse on your side, you know, at least we can try and prevent that for future. And I think that we need to kind of look at our calendar, you know, to make sure that we pick all of the boxes. So coming back to the submission, this year we are looking at how does one move people out of poverty? And we acknowledge that the intergovernmental fiscal relations system is not the major driver. But we believe that how the intergovernmental fiscal system is structured can play a major role in either supporting or inhibiting government's poverty alleviation efforts. And so what we then look at is basically three main parts. But in the background, I think that we have to bear in mind that government fiscal consolidation still continues. For the last couple of years, we've been, since 2008, we've been talking about the impact of the global recession. With the Eurozone problems continuing and possibly worsening, you know, the international environment is not going to get better for us. And we know that when international markets have a cold, we in South Africa sneeze, because we are very exposed as a small open economy. So, you know, within that background of very volatile international economies, I think that we all agree that the most pressing concern is actually sustainable job creation. We've got quite a well-targeted grant system, a social safety net system, but at the end of the day, sustainable growth and development rises and falls on creating jobs. Unfortunately, whether we like it or not, we are competing in international markets with counterparts like Brazil, like India, and like China. And these economies are actually changing. They're moving towards the knowledge economy. And so government doesn't have to do anything. The economy will move in that direction. The question for government is, do we make sure that this transition to a knowledge economy is actually inclusive? Or will this transition to a knowledge economy actually deepen the digital divide between those who have access to the formal economy and those who don't, right? How does that link to regional development? Because we tend to think in terms of jurisdictional boundaries, municipalities, provinces, but the way economic activity is structured across the country actually transcends those jurisdictional boundaries. So when we look at those issues, we are going to look at issues of job creation and the IGFR system. My colleague Ramos Mabogo will look at that. And then we'll look at how can we make the knowledge economy more inclusive. And we look at e-education and public university spending. I'll be dealing with those. But besides the poverty alleviation and combating inequality, we also at the same time have to deal with the fact that there's climate change and there's environmental sustainability issues. So we have a cluster of issues that we want to raise on the impact of climate change on rural areas. The committee will remember that in our previous submission we had concentrated on cities, and we had promised that we would extend this research to focus on rural areas and what the impacts will be. Then disaster management and solid waste management at municipal level. And then to just acknowledge that in order to play this developmental role, to eradicate poverty and to build resilience to climate change, we really need to have institutional capability within government. And in terms of the institutional development, we then look at aggregate revenue and expenditure assignments and how these have impacted on economic growth. We look at alternative service delivery arrangements at municipal level. very important is the issue of capacity at local government level. The committee will remember that we raised this issue before, but we've done subsequently more research that we can share. And then finally, gender responsive budgeting at local government level. I think that it's important to realize that when we look at the institutional capability of the state, it's important not only to look at technical implementation ability, but also the ability of government to really mobilize citizens, and in this case, women, in their own development. So those are some areas that we'd like to share some reflection. So with that, I'll hand over to Dr. Mabuso.
Thank you. The first chapter in part one looks at perspectives and prospects for job creation in the intergovernmental fiscal relations system. And the point of departure is the 2009 global economic crisis that induced a recession for the first time in 19 years in the South African economy. What we've seen since then is a modest recovery in terms of the output growth, with some slight improvement in the employment situation until last week, when we got figures that the improvement in employment was not sustained. In any case, the unemployment situation is still worse than it was before the crisis set in. In 2008. So the major concern that we are focusing on is the sluggish economic growth combined with high unemployment, and how we can use the tools at the disposal of government to address that problem. Now, the main findings from the chapter are that there are really no easy answers, and I'm sure the honorable members will be aware of that. We find, after careful analysis, that higher government spending on its own is not going to be sufficient to create the necessary jobs. Neither is higher spending on infrastructure alone going to be sufficient to solve the job creation problem. So infrastructure spending is not a silver bullet to address the unemployment problem that the country faces. In fact, what is even worrying is that even productivity improvements on their own aren't going to be sufficient to attain the job creation targets, not just the 5 million jobs by 2020 of the new growth path, or the 11 million jobs by 2030 of the national development plan under current discussion. Now, if one looks at the implications of those higher spending trajectories on current spending and infrastructure, what we find is that they have unintended consequences in the long term, in that they hit directly on the budget deficit. And from the budget deficit, government savings fall, and when government savings fall, overall savings in the country go down, and that impacts on private investment, so that future growth prospects actually get compromised from the intentions to create employment. So with that, we think there are important lessons here, that taking into account long-term considerations of current government policy are important, and this ties in quite nicely with the idea in government now to focus a lot more on understanding the longer term effects of fiscal policy on not just current distribution but future generations as well. So the message that's coming out from our analysis is that fiscal policy on its own is not enough. We need complementary policies which distinguish the short-term and longer-term interventions. some interventions may work in the short term, 2013-14, which is the horizon we are discussing now. But when you look at the longer term horizon, they are pretty blunt interventions. So you do need to take into account the bluntness of the interventions in the current period. And the sooner we begin focusing on the long term, the better or easier it will be for the country to make the long-term necessary adjustments. With these findings, we come up with a set of recommendations. And these recommendations need to be understood both in the short-term and the long-term aspects that I spoke about. And by the short-term, I'm referring to the period 2013-2014, maybe to 2015, and by the long-term, I'm referring to 2020 onwards. So in the short-term, I think we recommend that redirecting government spending toward activities that directly and indirectly create jobs will be beneficial. And in particular, activities such as healthcare, durable goods manufacturing, agriculture, community services, hospitality and food service have great potential for adding in extra jobs onto the plate. We also think that in terms of strategy, at least in the short term, efforts need to be focused on promoting lower paying positions, because there is highest potential for the most job gains. And the way to understand this is that when you look at how we characterize unemployment in South Africa, most of the unemployment, the above 20% that we're talking about, is essentially in the unskilled ranks. So a strategy of government needs to address unskilled unemployment. To give you an illustration, if you eliminated skilled employment, unemployment will remain above 20%. So that tells you that in terms of focus, government efforts should be directed towards addressing unskilled unemployment, especially in the short term. And Commissioner Jam will speak to longer term considerations aimed at skilled jobs later on in chapter 2 and 3. We also call for reduction in unemployment by addressing other factors other than weak demand for goods and services. And here in particular, we have ideas on the use of mechanisms that range from providing funding through a block grant to direct government operation. Government could redesign procurement policies with a direct focus on growing the small to medium enterprises in the informal sector, where a lot of the unemployed people have the potential of getting absorbed into the system. Could also earmark procurement contracts for low technology or service-oriented sectors, because in the short term, that's where the highest bang for the rand is likely to be in. A better targeting of supply-side interventions for reskilling and mobility of unemployed is also another interesting area, because we find that the mobility of the unemployed, unskilled, largely female young people seeking work are highly immobile. So better targeting of mobility intervention will assist with the job search processes of those groups in the short term. And then we realize that government has several arms that directly and indirectly play on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. And there's really nothing stopping using those arms, such as the PIC, etc., to invest in companies that have great employment potential or are generating the jobs that government wants to address. So certainly, government can do quite a lot given existing mechanisms. Then we also encourage we also recommend that through the Department of Labor, and performance monitoring and evaluation, government should encourage companies that yield the highest employment levels. And this needs to be publicized every year, where government sets up an incentive scheme through those departments that recognizes the companies that are contributing towards directly meeting the job creation role. We also call for development and implementation of credible job plans for each sphere in collaboration with a broad set of actors ranging from teachers, secondary schools, unions, universities, vocational training centers, and business support providers. And the idea here is that as a commission, we see a prisoner's dilemma outcome where, when you look at unions, business, and government, each is stuck in a mode where they are maximizing their self-interest. And as a result, the outcome for society or the outcome for jobs is not what one would expect. So on page 31, we propose a clear set of criteria that these players can actually use to evaluate job plans and see if a social contract could be built around those sets of criteria with it, at least the three sets of players working towards setting up of a social contract. Thank you, Honorable.
What I'd like to move on to is to focus on the efficient financing of e-education. Now, I think that the members all know and are all outraged by the fact that we still have kids who are learning under trees in provinces like Limpopo and KZN and the Eastern Cape. So the question could be asked, you know, is it a distraction? Is it frivolous to be looking at e-education? Shouldn't we be looking at the basics first? And unfortunately, as I said before, the world economy is moving on. And e-education is rapidly becoming the basics, right? So this is why the Commission is trying to focus attention on the use of e-learning in the classroom. Now, we note that access to the internet can also help schools manage themselves better. For example, access school management systems like the SA SAMS School Administration and Management System. But we are not going to focus on that. We are going to focus mainly on the e-education side of things. And if you go back to 2004, the Department of Education at that stage was one of the forerunners in putting in place a policy on e-education. What we'll see is that that policy has by and large not been funded and not been implemented, even though the date that was set in that policy was by 2014. And 2014 is basically just around the corner. So we note that there are a number of e-school projects being run, including those of the Department of Basic Education, Communication, and Science and Technology. But what we feel is that we need to move from projects to whole-scale access of the basic education system. And our concern is that e-education and e-learning has largely been left to provinces to fund. And as you know, when provinces face financial pressures, pressures to pay salaries, etc., often things like e-education and internet access are seen as nice to have, and they end up being underfunded. What we note with concern is that schools differ widely across provinces, from those that have good infrastructure to those where madras are actually used as classrooms. And to just give the committee some idea of like what the variations could be, there's not a lot of data, but we do know from the annual survey of schools what schools have email addresses, right? So in the Western Cape, 99.7% of the schools have email addresses, right? In the Eastern Cape, it's only 11% of the schools have an email. In Limpopo, 10.4%. KZN, 15%. Mpumalanga, 18%. Sorry? So Eastern Cape, 11%. Limpopo, 10%. KZN, 15%. Mpumalanga, 18%. Okay. 100%. 99.7%. Okay. But the point that we're trying to make is that that email is dial-up. Right? It's just sending text email messages. What schools really need is broadband. Right? Okay, so that they can access web-based e-learning content. We won't be able to put libraries physically in every school, but we can give every school access free to e-education and e-libraries. Right? And so really, this what this means is that these kids who are leaving these schools, the school doesn't even have one email access. We might create jobs, but these kids may not be employable, right? Because more and more the modern economy is asking that they be computer literate and they be comfortable in that environment. So, yep. Unfortunately, it's not in the report. I will leave this document, but I can give other figures. Three states, 27% of the schools have email addresses. Okay. Gauteng province, 58%. So you'd expect Gauteng to be more enabled as a province, so that is surprisingly low. Northern Cape, 41% of the ordinary schools have email addresses. Northwest, 38%. And then I said, you know, Western Cape, 99.7%. The average in South Africa is 26%. So that means that 3/4 of the school don't even have one computer with an email address on it. So we feel that given that we've got greater diversity of learning environments, there must be an intergovernmental financing mechanism to deal with e-learning as a kind of a specialist focus. And there are, basically technology has moved on. So now you don't need to build labs anymore. You can use mobile technology, right? So it's not all e-learning that actually requires a maximum expenditure. But the more advanced forms of e-learning do actually need broadband connectivity. And so we need to look at what are some of the options. You know, can we link schools directly to government's virtual private network? Can we use cities? Some of the cities like Cape Town, Ekurhuleni, Joburg, Pretoria, they are already making their networks available to schools to access free last mile access. Is it possible for us to maybe fund even more secondary cities to be able to do this? And then there are new technologies like small Wi-Fi or WiMAX networks, which are wireless networks. So you don't actually need to have cables. You know, we could actually investigate wireless technology in order to reach these schools. So what we need to understand better at this stage is why, when we've got a very good e-education policy, are we not rising to the e-education challenge? And some of our research basically points to the need for concerted cultural and technological adaptation. Right? You will never replace the teacher in the classroom, but e-education can really be integrated into lessons to actually make them more exciting and really reach out to the youth, because we live in a society where the youth really is very geared to technology. But teachers might need a lot more training to how they can use technology as an integrated part of the way they teach. As we mentioned before, education is a concurrent function between national and provincial governments. So the policy might be at national, but at the end of the day, it's provincial governments which actually are supposed to fund. Right now, we actually don't have very good information on what is the access that school has and schools have and what progress has been made since 2004. So monitoring and evaluation of provincial governments really needs to be improved. We also need to have explicit budget allocations for e-education. We actually try to do a budget analysis, but you actually just get baskets of funds in sub-programs, and it's really difficult to actually trace that to how much is being spent on e-education. And we need supporting strategies and funding, and also building public accountability for policy implementation. School governing bodies and communities can play an important role in basically giving feedback on whether implementation is actually taking place. And what we are proposing is that because the education sector will require a firm and expert guidance on designing e-education, the government might consider having an e-education commission that will bring together the national and provincial departments of education, but also telecoms regulators like ICASA and the private sector. Because if you look at private sector cell phone operators, IT operators, etc., they, as part of a licensing agreement, have had to give access to 17,500 schools. Whether that has happened or has not happened is a matter of debate, because we see very little impact. So there is a possibility of ensuring that private sector providers do actually contribute, as well as involving school governing bodies, as well as departments like communication, science and technology, higher education, etc. We note that there's limited data available on e-education expenditure, and specifically on e-learning expenditure, and we are recommending that this should be remedied through making explicit budget allocations in the annual budgeting process and through explicit reporting on expenditure on e-learning and e-education. So we should understand what each provincial department's e-learning objectives are, and we should actually be able to track that down to school level to see how schools are making progress and where there are implementation bottlenecks. We feel that a well-structured intergovernmental financing mechanism should be established with explicit guidelines to provincial departments of education regarding the budget line items that require prioritization. So I think that e-education is critical to building the skills that will make future young adults employable. The other area that we wanted to look at was the higher education sector. Unfortunately, we were not able to find much data on further education and training colleges. So we will continue research in those areas, but what we will do is present our preliminary results on funding of universities. As we noted before, South Africa is going to transition from a low value-added economy to a more knowledge-intensive economy that requires more intensive knowledge workers in order to increase the proportion of medium to high income jobs. The question is whether it will just be the privileged that have access to those jobs, or whether we can bridge the digital divide and ensure that the rural children and children from previously disadvantaged schools also can compete in the knowledge economy. So if we want to do this, we really need a strong, adequately funded post-education system that funds FET colleges, vocational institutions, and universities adequately. What we'll be focusing on in this set of recommendations is the higher education university sector, and in subsequent research, we hope to focus on the other areas. So what we do is we actually do an analysis where we look at the higher education institutions in the country. If you turn to page 51, there's a very instructive table where you'll see on the vertical axis all the higher education institutions, whether they be comprehensive universities or technicons. And then on the horizontal axis on top, you basically see the performance indicators that the department has set for those universities. Some are input indicators, some are output indicators. So, for instance, you'll see that the first indicator would be science and technology majors as a percentage of total enrollment. For example, the University of the Northwest, that would be 18%. In Limpopo, it would be 47%. Right? So you could look at all the objectives of these universities, and what the table does, it kind of gives some idea of the performance. When we look at this table, we can see that the higher education system is moving towards achieving these goals, but it's not meeting national development goals. In particular, there are problems with unsatisfactory output rates. We find that many universities have student failure and dropout rates, which are high and well beyond national targets. And then graduate and research output rates in all but a few universities are well below national targets. So obviously, we need a very strong research infrastructure if we want to support a knowledge economy, and universities are one of the prime areas where that research actually takes place. So given the type of performance analysis that we've presented here, it is clear that current funding mechanisms are too blunt to steer the higher education in effective ways, because it is clear that different institutions are actually facing different types of performance issues and therefore requires different types of funding arrangements. These mechanisms are currently being examined and reviewed by a ministerial committee set up by the Department of Higher Education and Training, and we have had contact with the department, and we hope that some of our recommendations can also enrich that debate. What we are suggesting is that a new framework will have to be introduced in South Africa based on different funding principles and on a policy of institutional differentiation. So if you look at that table 51, you know, what our research has indicated is that you can actually cluster these institutions of higher education into three clusters in terms of their performance. So we feel that the funding system should be sensitive to where different institutions are and also try and achieve certain objectives. For instance, overcoming the funding inequalities of previously black universities. You'll notice that in our report that many of the formerly white universities are able to access private donor funds over and above what they get from government. So there are huge funding disparities once you take private donor funding into account. We also need to make sure that somehow the funding system helps different universities achieve these types of targets that the National Department of Higher Education has set. And also we need to ensure that all universities offer high quality undergraduate training, and that those universities who do offer research continue to expand their research, and we do gradually get universities who are not doing engaged in research to find a niche market where they can actually do their research. So the Commission's concern is about the size, direction, and impact of funding of higher education and the school system as a whole, especially in the three areas that require funding, higher education qualifications, further education qualifications, and research. So what we're suggesting is that any funding system for universities should consider introducing a differentiated funding framework for a differentiated public university system by shifting it from a unitary system to three funding frameworks, one for each of the different clusters. So if we go to page 61 and 62, in specifically, if we focus on page 62, when we look at these different clusters, 63, if we look at the different clusters, for cluster one, the funding framework would acknowledge that their performance is satisfactory, but that they need to have further advances in equity of graduates, development and improved performance in input and output indicators. For cluster two, the funding framework would reward performance on input and output indicators and also assist cluster two to move up to cluster one. Right? So for instance, if these universities don't have sufficient academic staff with doctoral qualifications, help them to actually graduate up the ladder to cluster one. And then in cluster three, this funding framework would reward performance in the input and output indicators and moving up to cluster two, pushing for performance in order to win rewards. So what we're suggesting is that a funding framework must be sensitive to where the university currently is, but also provide support and incentive for it to actually move up the ranks in order to improve its performance. So our recommendation is that that the review of the funding framework, which is currently taking place, needs to be supported by research on formulating a future funding framework model that divides revenue into funding for higher education, further education, and research in the most optimal way. And we note that data is extremely lacking. So in order to better understand and analyze the performance of the further education and training sector, which we want to do in the next round, that the DMIS education system be expanded to incorporate the FET sector as well, or a parallel system should be introduced to collect the relevant data for analysis of the FET sector. Okay, with that, I'm going to hand over to Dr. Ngubi.
Thank you. I'm going to look at the first chapter of part two, and part two acknowledges that climate change disasters are more frequent. There are, and also non-climate change related disasters are very frequent, and our communities are very vulnerable to these particular disasters. So the issue there in part two is how do we make or get these vulnerable communities to be more resilient to the impact of climate change and to improve adaptation and mitigation. So chapter four, as Commissioner Ajahn has said, it looks at the impact of climate change in rural areas. The continuation from last year where we looked at the impacts in cities, and specifically this particular chapter has two objectives: to look at the impact of climate change in rural areas first, and secondly, to identify which municipalities are vulnerable to climate change. So with these particular objectives, with a number of key findings, we looked at first the impact of climate change on agriculture, which is the mainstay of people in rural areas. We looked at the impact on subsistence farmers and commercial farmers, and these farmers, we divided them into mixed farmers, crop farmers, livestock farmers, or for commercial farmers, we had also the element of horticulture there. And our findings point out that there would be adverse effects of climate change, mainly on crop farmers. And if you look at the graphs on page 66 and 67, they show the impact of climate change between different farming groups, and crop farmers, livestock farmers would be hit hardest by climate change, while it's mixed farmers will be less hit by climate change. And the pictures there show the current scenario in 2020, 2050, and 2080. That's a long-term view of the impact of climate change. Then we also, in terms of vulnerability, we used a vulnerability index where we ranked all municipalities in the country in terms of how they are vulnerable to climate change, and we identified the 20 most vulnerable municipalities to climate change. They are listed there. That's very important, especially when we are targeting, when we have some instruments to target these particular municipalities in terms of adaptation or mitigation. So it's important to identify which municipalities are vulnerable. So those 20 were the most vulnerable municipalities. Then in terms of recommendations, we made 4 recommendations on the basis of our findings. The first one is that the Department of Environmental Affairs and the National Disaster Management Centers should develop a vulnerability index. That's a key tool in terms of identifying who is vulnerable to climate change and who is not, and how you target those vulnerable communities. So there must be a development of that particular vulnerability index. And secondly, the Department of Cooperative Governance should adjust the objectives, terms, and conditions of the MIG, the Municipal Infrastructure Grant, so that it also takes into account the ecological infrastructure. And in particular, this grant should be used to fund climate adaptation, that is to reduce the vulnerability of communities, and also it should fund mitigation, that is lessening the burden of climate change to communities. And investments from this particular grant should target those municipalities which are more vulnerable to climate change. And thirdly, we recommend that the Department of Cooperative Governance should restructure the special municipal infrastructure grant window in the MIG so that municipalities are allowed to use that fund to rehabilitate ecological infrastructure. Then lastly, the Department of Agriculture, Forest and Fisheries should expand the provision of rural agriculture extension and support services, especially to small-scale municipalities, so that they can increase their uptake of climate change resilient farming. We know that they are providing such support services, but the point here is that it should be also cater for climate change and improve the uptake of climate resilient farming strategies that will enable these communities to adapt to and mitigate the impact of law of climate change. That is chapter 4.
I'll take you to chapter 5, which is on page 73 of the document, which is the alternative financing mechanism for which is alternative funding mechanism for disaster management in South Africa. We are aware that the severity and the frequency of disaster is beyondly increased. Some of the attributable factors with which, as my colleague has mentioned, is because of the climate variability, the change in weather patterns, the inefficient land use, the growing population, as well as assets are in high risk. Internationally, we find that in our studies, the emphasis now has moved more so to funding for disaster risk mitigation, which is on ex ante, what has measured that needs to be in place so that when the impact happens, the burden is not much than the use of the ex post, which is the current focus mostly in South Africa. When there's an emergency, that's when we rush to make sure that everything's in order. Some of the challenges that we found in the study was that the legislation, the policy, and the institutional frameworks currently in place are not adhered to by the spheres of government. We find that the responsibilities
and sanctions are not clear between the spheres. They find that if a disaster happens, local government does an assessment. Same thing goes to the provincial, it does the assessment. Same thing it goes to national. So there's some duplication of efforts that also delays the time when the disaster happens and when the funds need to be dispersed. And we find that also this the funding for disaster management is not at its optimal. More so because municipalities are not clear what they are supposed to be doing, and in most circumstances they label this function as an unfunded mandate. Going to recommendations, please, when you read this recommendation, read it with the first one that Mkululu mentioned on the vulnerability index, because you cannot separate climate change and disaster because they go together. So that was our first recommendation. The second recommendation, we are saying that the Minister of Culture should streamline guidelines and gazette uniform standards governing and guiding the classification, the declaration, and the assessment of response in line with the Disaster Management Act and the National Disaster Management Framework. Currently in place, I've been with the National Disaster Management Center. They are currently reviewing the guidelines because they also in agreement that things are not working accordingly. We are also recommending that COCTA, through the Disaster Management Act, should require the integrated development plans of municipalities, starting with the most vulnerable, to incorporate disaster risk reduction, evaluation strategies and measures, including the land use planning and management measures, including the use of building standards, because sometimes we can mitigate these risks if there are building standards or codes that need to be adhered to. We are also recommending that government should develop a policy framework for municipal disaster risk financing that differentiates between municipalities, because we know that municipalities differ, and this needs to be leveraged with private resources, and that we need to encourage and incentivize the use of innovative-based financing mechanism, where we can also look at the option of insurance mechanism as another option. We are also saying that in this instance, National Treasury, in managing fiscal risk, should require environmental management and vulnerability objectives that needs to be explicitly incorporated into the design of the existing payment grants. We know that currently in place there are existing grants like the MIG and the Human Settlement Grant. We are saying into this instance, sometimes we don't need more funding. We need to integrate the existing grants to make sure that they do have adaptation and mitigation measures in place, so that when these events or this occurrence happens, the impact is not that great. Moving on to the next chapter, which is on page 82 of the report, which is the financing of solid waste management in South Africa. This chapter really explores the institutional, the policy and legislative fragmentation that give rise to the inadequacies and inequitable funding to this sector. We have found that in this study that the poor costing of capital, operation and maintenance and environmental of solid leads to unsustainable and poor cost recovery models and poor revenue generation for waste management. We find that currently we have a meeting with the Department of Environmental Affairs. The cost of this service, solid waste management, is not known. We found that also solid waste recycling can have a potential to directly and indirectly create jobs through the use of PPPs in the recycling initiative, and through the uses of business that purchase those recyclables. We also find that there is a need for a certain approach to waste management alternatives and their adequate funding, which needs to be based on the waste hierarchical structure as adopted by the National Waste Management Strategy in 1999, which is on page 83 of the document. We talk about the avoidance of waste and the minimization, the recycling up to the last phase, where if there are no other alternatives, then you dispose the waste to the disposal site, which is the landfill site. We are also saying that while refuse removal is a free basic service for the indigent, most municipalities do not have resources to offer for this. You find that most municipalities, they don't even have proper update of the indigent register in place, and such, they don't even know who needs to qualify for the service. Therefore, in moving to the recommendation, we are saying that government needs to adopt a phased approach to the implementation of a full costing accounting by municipalities for solid waste management. We are of the idea that it can assist really in knowing what is the cost of the service, because currently the cost is only on the financial side. We don't look at the broader level, which includes the macroeconomic stability, the socioeconomic circumstances, as well as the environmental effects. So we are saying that if there can be a combination of internal and external cost-benefit analysis, perhaps it can give us a right direction in terms of costing the services. We are saying that government should take greater advantage of the opportunities for job creation in the solid waste sector through enhancing the structure of incentives for municipalities to create green jobs through labor-intensive service delivery approaches. We are saying that we need to specifically review the EPW grant, the MIG, the Green Fund currently in place, where it can really assist municipalities in making sure that they've got innovative measures in place and labor-intensive waste collection and reduction facilities that can really benefit the most disadvantaged. And moving on, we are saying that the Department of Environmental Affairs should delay the implementation policy on the regionalization of solid waste landfills until such time as the fiscal risk and benefits for municipalities in their different contexts is understood and adequate decision support measures for municipalities are in place. We are also saying that government should emphasize the expansion of access to solid waste services to poor communities while strengthening the policy framework for the provision of free basic removal services. We are saying here that the Department of Environmental Affairs actually needs to commission a review of the free basic services policy which is currently in place to specifically focus on its impact, on whether it has expanded the services, on whether it has really made sure that it the households do really there is an improvement in the reduction of illegal dumping. So I think that these things need to be done so that they are in line with the policy currently in place.
Jane, we now move into the third and final part of our submission and this presentation, and it will cover. Okay, we'll. It'll cover four aspects, namely decentralization, service delivery mechanisms, capacity, and gender. The sub theme underpinning this section of the. Can you go back to the previous slide, please? The sub-theme underpinning this section of the submission is institutional development for inclusive growth and innovation. So each chapter within this section interrogates institutional and developmental issues that have the potential of unlocking value at sub-national levels of government. So moving to the first part, the overriding question of this chapter, which focuses on the impact of aggregate revenue and expenditure assignments on economic growth, is whether South African provinces and municipalities play a useful role in promoting economic growth. And if the answer is yes, in what way? Is it through revenue assignment, expenditure assignment, or both? So our research findings indicate, and it's summarized on the table at the bottom of that slide, that revenue and expenditure assignment at provincial level have a negative effect on provincial economic growth. And there are a number of potential reasons for this. It could be that it's the result of excessive spending on the wrong expenditure items. So in this case, even if the level of decentralization is optimal, spending on the wrong items could lead to lower growth. Secondly, lower growth could be the result of incorrect revenue assignment among different spheres of government. So for example, national government may be better than provincial government in raising revenue. At the municipal level, revenue decentralization has a positive effect on economic growth, whereas expenditure decentralization negatively affects economic growth. So basically, this finding indicates that expenditure assignment at the local government level is inappropriate. So there are four key recommendations flowing from this research. Firstly, we recommend that the key principles of national strategies, such as the National Growth Path and the Planning Commission's vision for 2030 need to permeate into provincial and local strategies, and this can be achieved by translating key principles from these strategies into complete sub-national strategies. Secondly, we as economic development powers are well placed at the provincial level. Economic growth powers could be better placed at the municipal level. Moving on, municipalities and particularly non-metropolitan municipalities should be encouraged to play a more direct role in economic growth, and this can be done through assignment of greater revenue and tax handles to municipalities. Also, when reviewing the fiscal framework, all of the elements of the fiscal framework should be reassessed to support the growth-enhancing role for municipalities. Then there is a need for municipalities to improve their revenue collection efforts, as our research indicates this can contribute positively towards economic growth. The next set of recommendations relate to alternative service delivery arrangements, and these types of arrangements can cover public-private partnerships, trusts, agencies, entities, and we are focused specifically on municipal agencies. So in South Africa, the use of agencies at the local level has dropped, and this has been due to two key reasons. The first has been the need to bring about some form of uniformity with respect to the establishment and form that agencies take. So whether they are established as a private company, trust, Section 21 companies, etc., they are now regulations guiding that. Secondly, we have found that the legislative requirements in terms of establishing these agencies are quite onerous, making it difficult, particularly for lesser resource municipalities, to use more creative delivery mechanisms. So key when it comes to alternative service delivery arrangements is for government to balance potential benefits and risks associated with their use, and the Commission's recommendations are geared towards achieving this balance. So the first recommendation calls for a review of existing legislation covering the establishment of agencies and the use of alternative service delivery mechanisms, and we specify the pieces of legislation that we think should be reviewed, and that's Section 77 to 78 of the Systems Act and Section 53 of the Municipal Finance Management Act. We also recommend that the establishment of municipal agencies or the use of any type of alternative service delivery arrangement should be strongly tied to an adequate level of performance on the part of the parent municipality. Now, there are cases where leadership in entities are sound and performance is good. However, if leadership and governance in the parent municipality is sound, it raises the probability of the agency doing well. We also would like to see legislation requiring municipal entities to make public details of their actual performance and plans more strictly enforced, and non-compliance should be reported to the Auditor General. We found in our research a fair amount of difficulty getting information on agencies and their performance. Sometimes the agencies do not have websites with reports are placed on the website. Sometimes parent municipalities, it's difficult to get information from them as well. So what we recommend is that government should establish a central portal focusing on financial and performance-related information on municipal agencies. Then finally, government, in particular National Treasury Public-Private Partnership Unit, should put together a list of criteria to assist municipalities in deciding whether or not a sound business case exists for the creation of an entity. And we give examples of the type of criteria that could be considered. Moving on, the next set of recommendations revolve around capacity. And as we know, this is a long-standing issue, and despite poor outcomes associated with the numerous capacity-related interventions we see, funding of new initiatives continues. Our research indicates that capacity constraints are often used to mask the real causes of municipal non-performance, an example of which could be the lack of clarity around powers and functions between spheres of government. In addition, capacity building initiatives have to date been applied on a one-size-fits-all basis, as opposed to being tailored to the unique conditions of individual municipalities. And then what we found key and a key missing ingredient is the lack of independent evaluations of outcomes and impact of training initiatives. So with respect to this challenge of local government capacity, we proposed 5 recommendations. The first is to move away from quick fix short-term solutions and focus on comprehensive and sustainable strategies to deal with the issue. And here we recommend that single capacity support agreements be established per municipality. Then environmental or institutional constraints, specifically with respect to the allocation of powers and functions and the formulation of conditional grants, be simultaneously adjusted. Then to improve the capacity of municipalities to perform their functions, is an urgent need to stabilize the medium and senior management aspect or component of municipalities through greater insulation from political interference in the retention of skills and in the recruitment process. And finally, on this issue, minimum competencies as entrenched in the Municipal Finance Management Act should be enforced so as to ensure that appropriate technical skills are in place. And based on our field work, the areas that came up in when we interviewed municipalities were the areas of revenue management, supply chain management, planning and project managers. I'll now hand over to Dr. Ruben to do the final chapter.
Chapter 10 assesses gender responsive budgeting in the local government sphere. First of all, it is important to point out that government has shown some commitment to gender equality. We have seen it through policies, different policies, through legislation, and even being a signatory to international protocols on gender. But despite all these commitments, we see that the commitments and outcomes are still different on the ground. The gaps are still very, very wide. If I could add some statistics which are in the document, we see that 43.8% of households are female-headed. And out of these female-headed households, almost a quarter of them fall into the poorest quintile, that is quintile 1. And if you compare that to male are just about 18% who fall into that particular quintile 1. So you can see the gap between different gender groups. So we are saying the budget is perhaps one particular instrument which we could use to narrow that gap between different gender groups. So this particular chapter assesses the gender responsiveness of municipal budgeting process. We look at the entire budgeting process in the local government sphere and interrogate it for its gender responsiveness. So when we talk of gender responsiveness, really we're talking budget responsiveness to gender. We're talking of the issue whether budgets are sensitive to the different needs of women and men or children or the different needs of different gender groups. Our key findings in this particular chapter in the local government sphere is first we found that there is weak translation of gender equality commitments into fiscal commitments. That is, there is limited gender responsive budgeting in the local government sphere. That's the main issue. And we also found that the focus is on equity and not mainstreaming of gender equality. What we mean by equity is that the focus is mainly on numbers, that we must have 50% female in this particular position is not really changing the entire system whereby there is the approach is gender mainstreaming than or gender equality than gender equity. And we also found that gender discourses are event driven. That is, the process is driven by events like 16 days of activism, which is an event but is not really focusing on a process of mainstreaming gender equality. Yeah, it must be 365, not simple. 16 certain days where you focus on that particular event. It must be a process. Then we also found that there is lack of gender disaggregated data. And if there is no gender disaggregated data, it becomes difficult to plan, to budget from a gender perspective. So those were the findings. And our recommendation, we recommend that national and provincial governments should run a pilot on gender budgeting in a few months in municipalities and see whether if it works or if we could learn some lessons from it, then we replicate it in other municipalities. We also recommend that national and provincial governments should ensure that gender planning is institutionalized in municipal IGPs by sector. And also, national and provincial governments should provide gender budgeting good practice guides and toolkits to guide the municipalities on how they should do their gender budgeting. Those are the sectors, water. In fact, in our study in the report, we looked at water, sanitation, housing as some of the sectors, and also we looked at early childhood development as one of the key issues. So those are the sectors we are saying they should be gender planning, must be institutionalized in those key sectors. Then lastly, for national and provincial governments, they should provide guidelines for collecting sex disaggregated data. This is very important, especially for planning and for gender budgeting. In the local sphere, we say again there should be some institutionalization of gender responsive budgeting processes. And the local government sector should build capacity for gender mainstreaming and gender responsive budgeting at the local level. We noticed that there is lack of capacity in those particular areas of gender budgeting. And we should ensure gender responsive appropriations and budget allocations. And lastly, the local government should ensure gender sensitive public participation and consultations at the local level. Those are the recommendations on Chapter 10. Thank you.
So Chair, we've managed to come in at under an hour. I don't blame the committee for feeling slightly overwhelmed because this is the distillation of 18 months of research.
Thank you very much. And the committee must just grasp in an hour's time. I hope you will propose a smoke break. You want to propose a smoke break?
A smoke break.
Comfort break. 5 minutes, I agree with it. Okay, if 5 past, let's continue. And welcome to those colleagues that are not here when we started. We received some apologies from the group.
I'm going to go to the committee.
happens.
Because I realized to do something I had to rest. I'm like, no, request. I took it upon myself. But yeah. Because sometimes you can feel muscles in there.
Otherwise,
Members, there is your information. I don't want us to say you deal with chapter 1 or what. Maybe we should just seek or engage on seek questions of clarity or comment, whatever we do. But I think that what will be important at the end is what we do with this information from here, where to. I think there's another question that at the end we will have to answer. For now, let's get into the content and engage. I had recognized Honorable Singh and Honorable Dr. Pandey, Honorable Mashiko, Honorable Matlakana, Honorable Singh.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to all the presenters from the FFC.
Just before you just get on, I guess Mr. Nolu, you do FFC recommendation.
Okay.
Yes, what happens is the FFC has submitted the recommendations. It's not National Treasury that responds to the recommendation, but National Government that responds to the recommendations. What National Treasury does is we're the overarching body that needs to ensure that they consult on these recommendations. So what we do is we consult with the relevant national departments concerned, so every department that's listed here, National Treasury will be in contact with them and we will be working out a response. Together with that, we also consult provincial treasuries as well as SELDA in the compilation of our reports. And at the end, we actually process it as part of our submission into the budget process. So it goes through various reiterations. So that's why National Treasury cannot respond at this stage, because it's not National Treasury that responds to the recommendations. It's National Government.
But after your process, you will not respond by the time we go to NTPDF. You'll only respond when you go to the final budget. Okay, Honourable Members.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the clarity. Like I was saying, that there are very many recommendations that I can identify with personally. I'm talking about myself, and I think my party will identify with in this presentation by the FFC. But for me, what is important for us as a committee is how do we now facilitate a conversation between the departments which are largely mentioned here, COPTA, Public Service Administration, Environmental Affairs.
Another thing, I think from the word go, I did make that request. That let's deal with that towards the end. I think it's going to distract us if we deal with that process. But at the end, let's come to that. Let's respond to that question. But for now, if we could just focus on the content, I want us to avoid to start there.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we're going to be very difficult to speak to the content because we've had a 1-hour, 15-minute presentation. We don't have all the information at our disposal that the FFC had. They've been doing this work over 18 months, right? There's certainly a need for us to engage them in a workshop. Honorable Kelderblom is saying workshop, but on the issues. I mean, how do you come to this conclusion? How do you come to another conclusion? What does the Department of Higher Education have to say on this particular conclusion? And that kind of thing. So I think for any one of us to engage and ask questions on why do you recommend this, is going to be difficult. Unless other members, I got limited intelligence. But, other members may have ideas where you're going to ask questions on page 8, page 12, page 16, page 24, and that kind of thing. But I would really think that we should rather focus on where to, Kovadis, where to from here, in terms of the process. What time frames do we have? Can any of these recommendations influence the 2013-14 budget? Is there enough time for conversations to take place? Should we be focusing on just one or two aspects of it as we move forward? But certainly, sir, I will not be able to comment on... We've had HSRC research. We've had PSC reports. Now we've got FFC. What do we do? That, for me, is the important question that we need to ask. Thanks.
A lot of members, I really want to plead with you. I hear what Honorable Singh is saying. And I don't want us to say, I mean, we all understand the context under which we had the Public Service Commission or the Human Science Research Council. And that's my own, what you call a suggestion, is that we must come back to those. I mean, with the HSRC, for instance, we did indicate that the 3 hours engagement that we have with them are not sufficient. But maybe, I think, to the questions of saying, in future, how do we ensure that there's value for money in this presentation? It's a question that we need to respond to. Earlier, Honorable Singh, when we started, you were not here, but I think that we did comment that, and many members perhaps were not here when we started, but we did make a comment that said, this is not the first presentation that FFC this year is making to Parliament around this process. It started or a week ago or 2 weeks ago in the what you call a forum of chairpersons. It is the second presentation. But FFC does this every year. So, and every year, if you look at the EME and the budget review at the end, and even the what you call a division of revenue. In fact, for FFC, if you look at the division of revenue, the National Treasurer has responses there in every division of revenue. So there will be what you call a responses. And I think that at the beginning we did indicate that FFC will also address legislatures, different legislatures on this. I think Ms. Fano indicated the processes that National Treasury would do. But as well, is to say the question that you're raising, that ourselves, how do we handle with this? At the beginning, I think I did indicate that the committees, individual portfolio committees, have taken interest in this. Since last year, there has been engagement with a different portfolio committee. But our role is to coordinate. But maybe what we should be doing now is to say that are there questions related to the what you call first to the presentation? Maybe we should start there, and we come to the process of now. How do we take it? How do we take the process forward? Honorable Dr. Fande.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, yes, it is a lot of information. It's a good presentation, but I must say it is. Let me rather say it's good paperwork. It's a lot of paperwork. And I think there will be a difficulty to make this practical, you know, or to implement many of these recommendations in some way or the other. I really foresee problems. It's a lot of recommendations on paper. Chairperson, before I start with my questions, Honorable Swart left earlier, but he put a question for me with your permission on his behalf. He said here that one of the recommendations in the presentations, quite correctly, is the promotion of lower paying positions, as there is the highest potential growth for job gains. But the question is, does our current labor legislation not inhibit these trends? this is a question from Honorable Swart. Chairperson, on page 6 of the presentation, it says that the sooner the country begins, you know, with solutions, and it says to ensure productivity effects of public investments. In other words, to enhance the productivity of the public sector, the better. And it says on page 7, to redirect government spending towards activities. This is one of the recommendations. Now, what we heard yesterday in the House, in Parliament, is that many departments redirect their spending. They spend also 100%, but at the end of the day, they reach only 50% or 40% or 60% of their targets. That is not productivity. So I want to know, in this recommendation, how you bring about redirection of government spending, not only to spend all the money to get to productivity, but connect it to the aims, the policy of job creation, the policy of the ruling government, the policy of government. So I find a difficulty, you know, that does it mean spend your money according to what you received in the division of revenue, or is it been measured on what did you reach at the end of the day, that you reach your target, that you get to the goal. Chairperson, then on the same page 7, it says, you know, reduce unemployment by addressing factors other than weak demand for goods and services. And then to reduce unemployment, you talk about grants. I found it difficult because, in fact, some of the grants discourage job creation. I mean, you know, we many a time it's been said in Parliament, we must teach to catch fish, not give them fish. I just want to say, you know, there are certain things that you can't actually connect with the recommendation, because the proposal in the recommendation does not encourage what the recommendation is saying. On page 8, Chairperson, I also found it some sort of a wish list. You know, when we talk about encourage through the relevant departments of labor and performance monitoring and evaluation those companies yielding the highest employment levels. But again, you know, you want to encourage the companies who have very high employment levels. But on the contrary, there are so many labor legislation and also the role of the trade unions that work against this recommendation being made by the Fiscal Commission. So I come to the honorable thing, you know, we will have, and Felderblom, we will have to have a broader discussion, an umbrella discussion of all the role players. To say this is what been the recommendation, but in the way of this recommendation, you've got these barriers and these obstacles, etc. Otherwise, we work on separate pillars, you know. And, I think it's informally also discussed in the tea break time that there are other political aims as well outside of Parliament that must also correlate into this. And we need, you know, if we don't have a joint process, the paperwork and the wish list, you know, will carry on. Chairperson, one more thing on page 10 where we talk about the components of the education process, the e-learning and the e-education. I must also again mention here that some of the basics, some rural areas don't even have schools or electricity or the basics. What to say about e-education? You know, not even telecom. There's no infrastructure. This is a step forward, while actually we need to go backwards to solve some of the earlier problems. And you know, administration. I see nothing in the recommendations about administration problems where infrastructure facilities like handbooks, you know, teachers' presence at schools. There's nothing being said about that. You can have the most perfect e-education systems, that if the people who have to implement and the administration process to implement it, if there are problems with that, I mean, it will stay paperwork and it will stay a wish list. Chairperson, lastly, on the environment, the climate change, it is also said here, very correctly, key findings, subsistence farmers, and it refers to the problems that climate change will have on the farming, the whole farming process. But nothing then in the recommendations. I can find nothing to say how can we assure food security. How can we assure
to keep the farmers going and to, you know, to attract new farmers to the market. There's nothing been said about assistance to the farmers. And if we follow the budget speeches of all political parties this past semester in Parliament, we will find that there are huge problems in the agricultural sector for the farmers to survive. You know, import taxes, subsidies, etc. There's a lot of things, but I can't see anything here in the recommendations of the Finance and Fiscal Commission to address that. We would like to see more solutions. If there are more solutions that are really crying out to be resolved, then there will be less problems and less recommendations for solving problems that can be solved on another way, if I can put it like that. Chairperson, so you ask us to ask questions on the contents and this, you know, on the recommendations. I know it's a lot of research work, and I know it is not an easy job, you know, to be busy with the redistribution of the income in South Africa. It's a very difficult task. And I had the opportunity many years ago at the HSRC to work with Professor Melt, the very first person who chaired the Finance and Fiscal Commission, you know, when we started developing the framework for the conditional, unconditional grants, etc., etc. It is a huge problem. And one of the problems that's been mentioned today that carries on since the establishment of the Financial and Fiscal Commission is the problem with local authorities. It's been mentioned by one of the presenters that there should be more closer communication or control of the collection of revenue on local level. How do you control that? Because what we find and what we read in the media is that local authorities become bankrupt because there's a backlog in the receiving of their revenue, the collection. Now, to say that we need a better collection of income, if there is not a better system, will the FFC still carry on and make a division on national level of the existing money instead of encourage or play a bigger role to make sure that money is coming from all tiers of government on a more proper way? Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you very much. Anna Gusna.
Thanks, Chair. And to conclude
that, Anna Gusna, before you come in, you know, the questions are directed to FSC. And I think that we should protect FSC as well, in that, you know, some of the terminology sometimes we're using there. I know, understand that we're political parties, we are political animals, we think politics in these things, where sometimes we shouldn't be. My understanding, honourable members, is that the summary that FFC is putting on the board is a summary from this book. Sometimes I know that Dr. Van Dijk is correct to say for the past few months it has been a nightmare for this committee to be able to also to read this, what you call the document which was given to us about a week ago, but we had a whole range of other things. So I think sometimes the language like that, a wish list, I have indicated that perhaps maybe not all of us have been having as an experience engagement with them. I think at the beginning I did engage, indicate that in terms of the Constitution, the FFC has got a responsibility to make recommendations to government. And those recommendations are not just a wish list. If you go through the division of revenue, some recommendations have been what you call implemented. And others have, you get all kinds of comment of what is happening with this recommendation, which recommendation is government adopting and implementing. If we have experience of the, and I do suspect that maybe we do not have the, we haven't experience of having worked with FSC in the past. But every year they make these recommendations, and they make different recommendations every year. So, but I'm not answering on their behalf. They are going to answer in terms of why certain things are not here, blah, blah, blah. But I just want to say to us, let's take recommendations as recommendations, because if you look at that division of revenue, you find that some recommendations have been implemented. Not just a wish list. I would really like us to treat this with a little bit of what you call a care, honorable members. Honorable Snell?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I should answer my question even after that. I don't know if I should ask my question.
No,
just guide me from moving hard.
No, ask any question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. See, I congratulate the Commission on the extensive research that you have done. But to me, and it's not a criticism, it's an observation.
No, yeah.
Where I find the report falling short, it's not analyzing the inhibiting factors to having the recommendations implemented, such as maybe the manner in which governance is structured in this country currently. So you're trying to get around things by governing through conditional grants, okay? Because the provinces and municipalities, there's no center that holds. It can only be discussed through Chapter 3 of the Constitution. If you're wanting to, for example, ensure that provinces implement the e-education, but national government, through the policy that they adopted, has got absolutely no authority whatsoever to ensure that when monies are appropriated from a province, they're appropriated in accordance to national policy. There's nothing. And that's where I find maybe the report falls short as an example. Then you say, yes, we need to ensure that there's maybe a line item that we can trace at a provincial level to be able to ensure that the e-education is being implemented. But if a national policy is in place, why then do funds not follow function? You see, now, Treasury, I understand, has got a role in this as the overarching, and then you go and speak to various different departments. But ultimately, the allocation of budget is a Treasury function. So then the executive is supposed to adopt this report or make recommendations on how this report functions, but Treasury then doesn't facilitate with funds. No? That to me is I don't understand how that works, and the first thing is the lack of maybe structural recommendations that need to take place to give effect to what you're actually wanting to see transpire. Even for example, how do you coordinate these throughout the various provinces and municipalities, these recommendations, when division of revenue to a large extent appropriates money to provinces in bulk numbers, basically. Then those legislatures, with their strategic plans and APPs, do the appropriation. Those strategic plans and APPs, where do they speak to the national strategic plan of concurrent functions and APPs? So, without getting those kind of models right first, it will become extremely difficult, in my opinion, anyway, to implement your recommendations throughout the country. So it's up to certain provinces, or it's up to certain departments to then make up their mind what kind of policy shifts must be taken, what kind of strategic interventions must be taken to give effect to this. And I would like to be able to see some kind of model researched on how to give effect best to your recommendations. Thanks.
No, it's fine. Come, you can continue.
Thank you, Chair. Also, my thanks to the people that are with us today for absolutely excellent document. I think that in their research, they also look at other countries like China. Of course, if you look at China, the economy and their agriculture starts in their rural areas. The economy infrastructure starts by loading huge buildings and what have you. But my biggest concern is, and I think also some of the other members mentioned here, is the question of e-education, which you said put on a very high level. I think that is a big challenge for us. I asked that question earlier on the other meeting. Why is it that the perception is that the outcome of our education in universities are not so good in comparison with other countries in Africa? For instance, it was a problem. I just want to see. And I think that brings me back to the point that I think that the chair mentioned earlier is that they must go now. What is the solution at the end of the day? And the other question that I am, and I may, I was a few minutes out, the land reform, allocation form. And yes, are you addressing it somewhere here? Or because it also comes back to the question that was by Honourable Snell. But the first one, higher education, I have a problem. We have many universities. What is the problem? Is the problem with the curriculum? What do you call it? The curriculum is there. Are all going for, you know, there was a stage many years ago that if you are a teacher or you are a reverend, then you drive with the Mercedes, you are the richest man and you are the pastor and the psychologist. You do everything. You mentioned change. Now, is our universities, are they on the right track? Because at the end of the day, the person at the job is at the people. So that is my question, and also in comparison with those other African states, and also if it is in line with the great countries, that of China and of India. But, as I say, agriculture, I'm a little bit concerned that the money that's put aside for this, that the question is more to treasure. Because we will not address this effectively. And we are not going to address land reform effectively. And I'm very concerned about the future, because it addresses food security, it addresses many other problems. Thank you, Chair. But I also just can say that this is so a lot of information that actually three reports, this report, the Public Service Commission and the HSRC is for me things that actually can guide us on the way. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. And we thank the Commission because we take it that research is always based on research. You are somehow enabling further research from new people by asking all types of questions. So, whatever we ask here, we think is a bit relevant, and if we want to do research, that I think it is to the advantage of art and service delivery. You refer to grant, it's just as I read this one, where you said grant should be redesigned to consider the quality of capacity building interventions. Then I was just concerned about this redesigning of this grant, because we have so many programs which we think are funded and they have to do with capacity building. Some are placed with the are being outsourced to the development bank, to all those other institutions that help the departments whilst implementing the grant. There's also that part that we take it, we leave the departments with some capacity and skills that are developed. So it causes concern because it seems that many replacements of and redesigning of grants that are going on. And we'd also like to know about, which also affects National Treasury, before we as Parliament can see the impact of a grant within the department, that grant is already moved to another department to do something. We have in this grant that has to do with sanitation. It has been moved so many times before we see if its impact with that department. National Treasury is already moving it something. We don't know how concerned you are about it as FFC, because there's a grant that you think is relevant to human settlement, but you know it has to do with sanitation. Very soon it will be moved to another department, and that has to do with fiscal designing of our revenue, because I think we first have to see the impact before we think of redesigning or moving a grant from one department to another. What recommendation does FFC have towards National Treasury? Because it affects us and it affects our service delivery, and at the end of the day, the poor people are the ones who are affected. And in your document on page 26 and 7, I just want, maybe my little knowledge of English makes me not understand, because we have this, well, we have like skills levels, and the other one is unskilled. Under unskilled, we have domestic workers, and in our organogram, on the other side, under unskilled labor, I don't know whether docile workers is the same as domestic workers. As long as you can clarify that part for us, because I just got worse because I didn't know what it is. And I think our questions are now constrained, because we'll have to wait and see how we can broadly ask questions to National Treasury without maybe touching what we are not supposed to touch. Thank you.
I think we should be free, Honorable Minister. I think we should be free. Let's not feel constrained, you know.
Thank you. No, I did consult the constitution before I spoke. I'm now more empowered with that. No, Chair, can I say that I think it is it is always a good and refreshing to listen to the FFC presentation, because of getting a bit out of the box in terms of the thinking. I think it's always refreshing. But could we not take this as an introduction? Today being the introduction on the fairly detailed discussion that has to still have to happen. Because if we don't do that, then we would comply, do the compliance box, and not really do the groundbreaking discussion with a view to changing the structure in terms of the budget. So I do want to say, Chair, that maybe if we can find a space, I'm saying this so that they know, there are a couple of chapters that we would have to focus into a detailed discussion in order for us to be educated, in order to do the work that we need to do when we engage with the Treasury. I'm happy that the Treasury says they can't respond, government will respond. It was a nice response from Treasury. So I think the important thing is for us to do what we have to do based on the Constitution as well as the Act that regulate our function. But for us to do that would need a little bit of a digestion of what we've heard in terms of the details, so that we are able to ask intelligent questions. So let me ask just a few quite a few short, probably ill-informed questions. There is something in the presentation that speaks to the funding mechanism, to which is blunt. I wasn't quite sure what that means, given the current funding and priorities and targets that are set in terms of the money that you get has to respond to what is set as a target. So I wasn't quite sure what that the reference to that means. What that. Then there's something around the issue of the funding that prohibits the target. Now, I wasn't sure whether is the funding issue or is the funding versus quality. The funding that you have currently and the quality doesn't speak to the funding in terms of... So it's easy, could be easy to divert attention to funding mechanism that is that prohibit the kind of output in terms of the quality of output rather than the other way. My question is, with the current funding, the quality is the one that is a problem which has been identified. So why would we go to that recommendation instead of actually drilling down around the issue of quality that expenditure has already been spent on currently? You've shown us the thing in the book. Now, there's something again about around that the graduates that do not meet the national standard, that national target. I think we use national target. And I haven't been able to read the book to understand that what it means. I wasn't sure whether what you refer to as a national target, are we referring to national target in a sense of quality or quantity of it? Because sometimes we did get a briefing that the outcome, the graduates and the job absorption of the graduates are not speaking to graduation, particularly when you have a two type of student that come from the same university. So I'm not sure about the national target. In a national target language, what are you referring to? Are you referring to volume, quantity, or quality in terms of it? Because if it's a quality problem, then what is it that we need to do in respect to that? Just a last question, Chair, is the issue about the data that you raised. You raised the question about the certain department that deal with the gender issues and the issue of development of data in terms of various issues. Now, currently we have a bit of a challenge of the data and the data reliability and proliferation of data development, which has challenges in terms of which of the data is reliable in terms of informing the budget and informing the program that we need to implement for a particular outcome. So the recommendation, I'm curious to understand the recommendation in relation to that discussion, that you already have those bodies that are doing some of the data, and it is a challenging one. Whether you look at the data from various other departments, there's always a reliability factor that comes into it. So I wasn't sure that is that a solution, or it's a movement towards a solution. Because at the end of the day, for us to be reliable, to have reliable data, is to have a quality of data. But where is that residing in terms of it? But here, if we're going to decentralize it, don't you think the decentralization of that data in terms of what has been suggested will speak to the quality of it and reliability of it? And how do we, what would be the mediating data factor? So that those are the, I have some here, but I think they are small questions in terms of this. But I just want to understand that. But my first point here is that I think we should take it as an introduction. I think we need to have a more discussion in order for us to be able to be effective.
Thank you, honored members. Just some further clarity, maybe they could be detective of some of the issues that have been raised. In those recommendations, you're saying, for instance, setting up an employment performance reward scheme for enterprises that excel in job creation. The government has now put out, for instance, some job creation funds. And I think that the Department of Trade and Industry has certain what you call a schemes already, including your textile what you call a scheme and all of this. So, and some people are saying, look, this is distorting the what you call the economy, because now government is beginning to subsidize employers. Now, this recommendation, for instance, where does it put that now? In which areas exactly do you think that should be done? And perhaps, I don't know how much what you call the research has been done in those areas in terms of now being sure that what is being is on the table by government perhaps is not sufficient, and are we able to say already what is on the table, is it working? But I don't think that this has been long on the table, this question of this scheme. It was an intervention after 2009 coming forth. There's been this intervention. So I'm not sure if there are, we have been able to research whether they are working or not working. Again, on the e-learning, education, you know, we are an appropriation, what you call a committee, we're supposed to be dealing with anyone. But there are about 35 departments or 38, including the entities. I mean, the small committee can't be able to deal with those, your strategic plans, annual performance plans, and everything else. We can't be able to do that. That's why the portfolio committees are dealing with that.
I'm not trying to defend ourselves for not being able to read. But now, I don't know. The question that I'm coming to, I heard the Minister of Communications is very aggressive in these days in terms of the ICT or E, what you call it, processes, whatever you want to call them. But I don't know if in the budget there is any, what you call, perhaps attempt by the Department of Education to deal with this. I do know for sure that after this agreement in 2004, there has been, I think the Department of Education had wanted to begin with the processes of e-learning, but maybe could be the problem was that where does it start? Does it start with the teachers, with the students in terms of training and what now? But I don't know if there are resources have been, what you call, put in order to be able to deal with the situation. I mean, in order to expedite it. Yes. We had, I think colleagues commented about the input that we had this past month. And one of them was from the HSRC. HSRC was saying to us, talking about the impact of unemployment, and one of them was about the graduates that come from those universities, the question of employability of those graduates, and they were saying to us, black students are more likely to be unemployed, whether they come from the same university as their white counterparts. Now, I don't know if you have done a similar research or perhaps, and if so, what were your own findings, and how can perhaps be dealt with in the milieu of things that are supposed to be dealt with. Yeah. The maybe without also going too much, I know that in the previous recommendations, I'm now going to another question of about the funding of municipality. What chapter is that, by the way? Revenue and that you were talking about. Sorry? Chapter 7. Could be chapter 7. Yeah. The I know that, you know, FFC, I think that it's insisting on this recommendation. You're not putting it the way you did it some way back when there was when the act, for instance, was done of extending taxation to provinces to have some kind of taxation power, you know. Now you're putting it now through the back door here. I must think now. Yes, chapter 7. National government, page 93, that the non-statutory should be encouraged to play a more direct role in economic growth. This can be achieved by national government assigning greater revenue and tax handles to the municipalities than is presently the case. Now, I mean, we have the act. I can't remember, Ms. Fano, what is that act? Municipal facilities, yeah. But the challenge with the act is saying municipality can do this, but on condition that it takes into account the other municipalities surrounding it. Now,
one issue. In other words, if any municipality wanted to do this work, it must also take into account about this. The what you call the administration of that. Thirdly, the fact that people the high unemployment rate, you know, that is. But I'm not sure how this envisages to take this. Those other sectors into account. And exactly, I'm not sure if there are certain sectors that you have identified, for instance, that you think that here the municipality can, what you call it, look at raising taxes and in particular areas. That's the last thing then before we the issue of disaster fund, I think somebody raised it, said that we I don't understand. On page 85, on the recommendations, you're saying the Department of DEA should delay implementing the regionalization of solid waste land policy until fiscal risk and benefit for municipalities are better understood. And adequate decision support measures for municipalities are in place. Well, unfortunately, we are not what you call those portfolio committees who are aware of some of these things. But I think this recommendation assumes that there is a recommendation to that effect. I'm not sure whether does this mean that this was supposed to be implemented, this regionalization, by when? Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Just to comment that last year we were privileged to engage. With many of the portfolio committees on a one-to-one basis. For example, energy, women and children, DCOG. So I think that we can safely say that we will have an opportunity to engage deeper on these issues. I also want to note that these are the executive summaries of the technical reports. So for every chapter, there's actually a full technical report with data. So I think that unfortunately we couldn't really do justice to all of the research. But what we will also be doing is liaising with the researchers of Parliament. We're having a special workshop with them so that they can really get to grips with the technical side, especially in anticipation of the budget review and recommendations reports. That's one of the areas that we also need to focus on. Okay, so I want to come back to some of the questions I'll ask myself, some of the questions I'll refer to my colleagues. I'm going to ask Dr. Mabogo to really talk to the issues of related to employment and infrastructure. On the education issues that Dr. Van Dijk raised, the issue was, some of the schools don't really have the basics. Shouldn't we go backwards rather than just focusing on the education? And I think that the issue is that we have to do both. Even the schools that have, like, email access is not good enough. So we need to really bring your basic schools that don't even have basic infrastructure up to speed, And at the same time, we need to look at those schools that meet norms and standards that might have been appropriate 10 years ago, but are not appropriate now, right? And I think that from the EPFC side, we actually have a project this year looking at basic school infrastructure and where that's located. And hopefully we will be able to share some of the research in that area. I think that I want to agree with the Honourable Member that it's really the practical elements that need to be put in place. When we look at even in this report, we look at two elements. One is, how do we train teachers to feel comfortable with technology? Because if the teachers don't feel comfortable, they are not going to be able to make the students feel comfortable. Right? And that's the culture and the change management that we're talking about. The other issues relate to basically budgeting, planning, monitoring. And the basic point that we're trying to make is that if you don't even measure this, it means that you're not managing it. Right? You know, that's really an area that we do actually want to focus on a lot more. But I think that because it cuts across many different departments and ITASA, you actually need to make sure that you don't just focus on the Department of Basic Education, but you actually make sure that those administrative procedures are there across all of the role players, including bringing in the private sector. I'm going to ask Nkululi Ngubi to deal with the food security issues. Then there was a question raised about revenue collection of municipalities, and the point that sometimes you actually have insufficient fiscal effort. So I think that the EPFC's approach is multi-dimensional, because we first say is, do we understand what is the fiscal capacity of municipalities? Do we know how much they could collect if they actually exerted full effort, right? What we do note is that fiscal effort, fiscal capacity has actually been declining across municipalities, and that they have actually become more grant dependent. So even if they were collecting everything, we need to understand what is the maximum potential that they could actually collect. Then there's the separate issue of whether bylaws are actually passed by municipalities and whether those bylaws are actually up to date in order to be able to levy tariffs and rates, and whether indigent policies are in place. Then there's the issue of actual systems. Often capacity building is seen as you know, training people, but we actually don't fill vacant posts, and we actually don't support adoption of better revenue collection systems, billing systems, meterage systems. And then finally is individual training to make sure that the individuals can really operate those systems. So I think that we are saying that all of these elements need to be addressed at the same time. You can't train people if you're sending them back to billing systems that are not working. You can't put in a new billing system, but it's run by consultants and the personnel in the municipalities don't know how to work it. And I think that this has been the problem of capacity building. You find that different national departments will descend upon a municipality, but they won't coordinate among themselves. So you might find that DCOG has got a team there, DPSA has got a team there, IDT might have a team there, but it's not really coordinating with each other. Then I think Honourable Snell raised the question that, look, national government can set the policy, but they cannot coerce municipalities to actually, provincial departments to actually make those allocations. What we are saying is that there are instruments at the national department's disposal that they have not used. Okay? For instance, it is only since 2009 that there's a sector education plan, which actually plans for the national department and all of the provincial departments together. Now, if you don't plan together, how are you going to budget together, right? So I think that this sector plan is way overdue. I'm glad it's in place. And the question is, are provinces really funding that
specific sector plan. Then norms and standards. We know that there are court cases, NPOs like Equal Education, going to say, look, we don't have infrastructure norms. We don't have norms for e-education. Making sure those norms are in place are the sector department's responsibility. If for some reason they don't have those norms in place, you know, you can't even begin to start enforcing the budget unless the kind of the planning norms are actually there. Then we've got all these APPs, right? But the APPs seem more to drive Treasury's purposes than to drive the national sector department's policy purposes. So APPs should actually talk to those issues that are important for policy, right? So why aren't we seeing these APPs having better sector content rather than being driven by compliance with Treasury, etc., right? I know that Treasury started it, but the aim of the Treasury and was that the sector departments would actually take ownership of that, right? And then if those norms and standards are not in place, the sector plans are not in place, the APPs are basically focusing only on compliance, you can't expect the budget allocations to really speak to those things. So those measurable objectives, there should be a measurable objective on e-education. How many schools have better access? If that was in the APP, then the Auditor General would basically audit it and the Portfolio Committee would know about it. Right? Okay. And that speaks to the monitoring and evaluation at provinces. They cannot say, okay, look, so many schools didn't have email addresses last year, but this year they actually do. Okay, not all of the provinces can do that. Right? So what we're saying is before you force budget allocations, that's the easy part. Rather get the difficult planning and policy part in place. And that takes national department sector leadership to do before you actually try and tinker with the finance. Equally important is oversight by the provincial legislatures, because the provincial legislatures pass these APPs, pass these budgets, right? And I think that building provincial legislative capacity to be able to ask these questions, to ask their departments, okay, why have you not budgeted for e-education? Why do only 11% of the schools in the Eastern Cape have email addresses? You know, we really need to strengthen the provincial oversight capacity. So I think that changing constitutional governance structures, that's actually the easy solution, because you don't actually want to focus on the difficult things, which is how we actually do our monitoring and evaluation, how we do our planning, etc. Then moving on to Honorable Gelderblom, did we look at China and other South African economies when looking at graduates? I think that in our previous research that we did, we said one of the major constraints on higher education is the quality of basic education. Okay, we know that when we write TIMSS exams, trends in math and science, we score lowest in our subcontinent. So even Mozambique, Botswana, all of those countries actually score better than South Africans. So in the long term, we actually need to improve basic education so that we can improve higher education, right? And I think that if you look at the plans that are in place, those plans are good. The issue is whether those plans actually translate into funding and whether they translate into actual implementation. I'm going to ask that I think Sasha can maybe speak to the issue that Honorable Macheka raised about the capacity building interventions, right? But I do want to pick up her point on shifting grants, right? If you see, as already said last year, that grants proliferate because sector departments, whenever they have a problem, the knee-jerk reaction is create a new grant. Right? Then the objectives of the grant change. And they basically change without much oversight over, do we really need to change the objective of the grant? Do we really need to change the location of the grant? Right? And then finally, they often just phase out without a process. And so last year we made the recommendation that there should be better grant design when we initiate a grant, when there's a major change in either the function or the scope or the location of the grant, and then also a phased exit strategy for when we withdraw that grant. Because often we terminate grants and the original objectives have not been met, you know, or there might, there needs to be a better phase out. So I think that this point of shifting grants before we actually see their performance is really an important one. It takes 2 to 3 years for a grant to even get up to speed. And, you know, it might be premature to change the original grant design, you know, unless you've actually allowed that period of time. I'm going to ask Ramos to speak to the issue of domestic worker classification. And I just want to come back to Honorable Ramaswamy's question on funding mechanisms. What we're saying is that we're not saying necessarily more funding, but what we're saying is that the funding needs to be more closely linked to performance. And how we define performance depends on where the university currently is, right? If we look at that table on page 51, we will see that different municipalities are at, different universities are at different levels in terms of the staff they have with PhDs, in terms of how many graduates they are actually pushing through. So we feel that the funding should actually be linked to where the university is at and how it can improve these basically performance targets, which were set in the white paper on higher education, right? And the issue that Honorable Ramaswamy raised is, like, are we focusing too much on funding and not sufficiently on the quality issues? Well, if you look at page 51, if you look at these input and output indicators, they are indicators of quality. You know, how many kids are actually graduating in sciences, in business? How many lecturers have access to masters and PhDs? Those are proxies for education quality. So I want to just agree with him that quality is really important. And what we're saying is that there needs to be an explicit link between funding and quality improvement depending on where you are. And that will kind of give you some idea of what you need to improve in order to graduate from cluster 3 to cluster 2 to cluster 1. There was also an issue, and I think the chair also raised that same issue, that there seems to be a gap between formal graduation and then employability, in other words, uptake in the labour market. Now, unfortunately, we have not done research on this, but I think it's an area that we do need to do research. What the area that the chair brought into it was, you know, the fact that even with the same institution, you can actually have a differential impact and absorption of black graduates vis-a-vis other graduates, right? Because what we know is that often employers use the institution as a proxy for quality, right? But if there seems to be different absorption rates, even within the same institution, then it tells you that it's not necessarily quality that's the issue, that there are other issues, maybe discrimination or something like that. But I think that we will note that as an area that we need further research in. On the issue of data, FET data and gender data, you know, as I said before, if you don't manage it, if you don't measure it, you're not managing it, right? And we are not asking for additional data. We are just asking for the data that you really need to manage the institution anyway. If you don't know how many people are currently enrolled in your institution, then it means that you're really not managing that particular institution. So we believe that the only way data quality will improve is if people like us actually use the data, and if parliamentary committees use the data. Because once people start talking about data, then you find that people will say, no, that's not true, or that is true, and you will improve the quality, right? So improving the demand and usage of data, that will create the incentive to actually improve the supply of data. On the issues of the employment reward scheme, I'm going to leave that to Ramos. On the taxation of municipalities, Chair, I think that the issue there is that there is a proposal for a local business tax that is going through. That proposal has to assess what is the impact of if one municipality introduces a local business tax, how is it going to impact on other municipalities as well, right? And that requires fairly sophisticated modeling work. We're still in the process of looking at that application, and we will issue a report on that. I think that what this chapter was trying to contribute was to actually look at actual data and say, you know, if you run these models, what do the data suggest? Because often we look at where powers and functions or revenue assignment should take place, and it's basically based on conceptual work, theoretical work, or other countries. But what we realized is that now we're starting to have enough data after about 18 years, 17, 18 years, that we can actually do empirical testing on some of these propositions. And then I'm going to leave the regionalization to the Monday. Rama?
Thank you. I will focus on the employment question, in particular the questions raised by Honorable Dr. Van Dijk, Honorable Masheko, and Honorable Togan. The first issue is that Dr. Van Dijk raised was the issue of current labor legislation and other institutions inhibiting creation of lower paying jobs. And this may be true, but the recommendation that we're making in as far as that's concerned has to do with what we think is a deeper issue, what they will refer to as the prisoner's dilemma outcome, where each party is maximizing its own objective. Labor unions are likely to maximize around earning the worker. Government is likely to be worrying about long-term fiscal objectives, and business is likely to be more concerned about the bottom line. So the way we have approached this is to recommend a criteria for the three parties to come together and work towards the social compact. And that's the box one that I referred to. So it may be that they are inhibiting aspects of the legislation, but those need to be addressed as one criteria that the three parties agree towards. So that's how we approach the issue of institutions and how they impact on job creation. Then you raise the issue of redirecting spending, and in particular saying you then go on to recommend grants, and yet there is a feeling that those actually can discourage employment. And the way we have thought through this is that there are short-term and long-term considerations. Sometimes when a problem is present, such as recession-induced joblessness, then you need to react immediately. And so those are the short-term solutions that are needed right there when the problem is there. It's no use intervening 20 years down the road when the recipient no longer needs intervention. So in terms of the particular grants that we are recommending here, we've identified that in particular for certain groups, women, youth, disabled, unskilled, they suffer from a problem of mobility. In other words, they get discouraged out of the labor force precisely because they're not mobile enough to go and look for the jobs themselves. So if you can't travel to a factory to find out if there's a job for you in the first place, then you're not going to, you're going to remain unemployed. So that's the sort of mobility grant that we're talking about here that needs to really be focused on, where you encourage job search or facilitate job search so that people don't remain outside of the system. So that's how we have approached the grant aspect of the recommendation. And I'm not recommending also grants to prop up employment.
No,
but this is a targeted, targeted grant for mobility to encourage job search. Then, Honorable Sogoni, you raised the issue of employment reward schemes, in particular activities taking place at TTI and textiles and so on, and that there is a worry that they may be distorting the economy, in particular by subsidizing employers, which can result in resource misallocation. Again, this particular issue, we've looked at the various interventions, all of them aimed towards creating jobs. And we distinguish them into short-term and long-term interventions. A lot of the ones that you spoke about should purely be for the short-term, 3 to 5 years, and they self-extinguish. And the reason for that that we come up with is that there is a clear failure in the market, where in the very short term, it actually makes sense to subsidize the employer to mop up the high unemployment level. When employment level persistently remain above 20%, we think that suggests that there is a systemic failure, and one needs to engage directly in the market. And the way we understand the intervention is that they should address the problem directly where it is, rather than an indirect intervention. But what we find again from the research is that when you look at these subsidy schemes, including the youth wage subsidy, the one aimed at jobs and textiles, etc., pretty much they are a drop in a teacup. We are talking about unemployment levels using the narrow definition of around 23%. And yet these schemes that we're talking about in terms of amount, one of them is 5 billion, another is 3.4 billion. So we're talking of a volume or level problem. They are nowhere near sufficient to make a dent on the problem. Even if you employ all of them full blast, we're nowhere near enough to bring the unemployment rate down from. So that's one of the bigger issues that we look into, that even with all these short-term interventions, you are talking about a movement from 23.2% to 22.2%. But that's not how we understand the problem. The real problem is bringing down unemployment to levels around 7%. So all that big gap is where the discussion needs to focus on. In other words, onto longer-term type issues. So once again, I emphasize the short-term considerations, where you actually give help when help is needed, and then focus on the longer-term aspect and how to bring about a social compact so that institutions strive towards a common goal that's called job creation. And I might add that, in fact, what informed the beginning of this project was when we came to this particular committee, when we were invited to speak to you at your strategic planning session, and you wanted us to talk more about how you could exercise oversight on job creation program. That's where we started thinking around this chapter. And what we now have, and this is now to come back to Dr. Dyke's question about redirecting spending and whether just spending 60% or 100% does the job. What we've subsequently done is, in fact, to tweak the commission strategic plan, where the focus is not just on spending, but the outcomes from the spending. And what we're able to do with the tools that we've developed is how R1 spent translates into X number of jobs. And that to us is where, in terms of outcome or impact, the discussion needs to be at. So if we spend X amount of rand, does that, how much number of jobs does that translate to, in spite of the spending proportions that we are talking about? So we have those tools to convert rand spent into actual number of jobs. Then to Honorable Mashiko on the domicile and domestic workers, your observation is spot on. The domicile should be domestic workers in the sector classification. And that one is informed by statistics in South Africa. That's the one that will be also that interpretation is common across.
Question on climate change. I think the comment was, or the question was, our recommendations do not go far enough in addressing issues of food security as well as problems which farmers face. Yes, we may not have addressed the problems of which farmers face, but I think the context here is very important, that our recommendations is made in the context of climate change. So with that in mind, you'll see that our recommendations begin to talk to issues of food security. If you look at the last recommendation in that particular section whereby we recommend increased support to small-scale farmers in terms of there should be increased support for mixed cropping, which will improve their resilience to climate change, diversification, and improved, or there should be support that will facilitate the training of these farmers in looking at those particular farming mechanisms that which are resilient to climate change, for example, drought-resistant farming, efficient irrigation systems, and we even talk of issues of funding or financial services, that there should be improved access to financial services, in particular microcredit schemes, is in one of our recommendations. So those recommendations, if you look at them, they begin to address the issue of food security. But in terms of general problems of farmers, yes, our recommendations did not go far enough because the context was climate change, not just the problems which farmers face. Thank you.
Sasha and Nomonde.
Just firstly, Honorable Mashiko raised concern around the continuous redesign of grants. As you know, each grant comes with a set of conditions that departments or parents, in this case municipalities, need to meet. So what we are calling for is that as part of the set of conditions governing especially capacity-related conditional grants, that it be compulsory for municipalities to conduct to do an independent evaluation of the outcomes and impact of a training intervention. So this will assist in determining whether, firstly, the tool being used is effective, and also whether we're getting value for money. So instead of just continuously allocating funding without knowing whether it's actually solving the problem.
Nomonde, regionalization of landfills.
Okay. Here we are saying that it needs to be delayed, and then the department needs to do a full cost-benefit analysis of the regionalization within a fiscal sustainable licensing and service delivery framework. Currently in place, we know that there are unregistered licenses that are used. So why has there been any study that has been done in terms of the full cost analysis? Because the department now is going ahead with the regionalization of this. So we're saying, hang on, yes, we want to do it, but first, we need to have these mechanisms in place, making sure that there is support on government framework for municipalities as the honourable members have said that sometimes there are no government structures in place, and then we can go ahead with this. Because currently, the department is. Can you just go and explain what you mean by regionalization?
Regionalization in terms of waste management services, or in terms of the waste disposal. Because we find that others maybe within the municipality, the area, instead of the municipality, just as one for time, then all of them will go there. Instead of maybe it will also be looking at the waste. But before that,
there was also a question on land reform. We have not done research on land reform, but I'm noting it down as a gap, because I think that there's a lot of issues on rural land tenures that is coming up for legislation, and that has got intergovernmental implications. I'm noting that. Dr. Mabogo, you had one more question on the HHRC question.
Yes, I think Honorable Sogoni raised the HSRC findings on racial vestiges in the unemployment. And in fact, the discrimination is even wider than just based on color. It runs along gender and age type discrimination. So you find that for some strange reason, certain employers put a premium on age as a screening device. So someone may be 23 years old with higher qualifications than a 43-year-old, and then an employer discriminates against a 23-year-old and hires somebody. Maybe because age is a reflection of experience or whatever it is. But even after you standardize for experience, you find certain employers prefer maturity in terms of age to the youth. The same on color basis, you still find employers that discriminate on color basis, on gender basis. And those things are a part of society that needs to be taken out of the system somehow, because it goes to the value system of an individual that they should really be addressed on a case-by-case basis. The point that we make in our case is that the real problem is actually the volume of jobs that's at the center of this problem. And that always gives the errant employer the power to screen according to other criteria. If the volume of jobs were not a problem in the first place, in other words, you are not rationing the number of jobs. There's no need to ration. There are a lot of jobs. Then a lot of these segregation type problems go away. So our main point, the underlying point, is that yes, they are these discriminatory elements that should be taken out of the system through addressing the belief systems and so on. But still, we need to eliminate the chance for rational jobs or giving jobs to people on color basis, on gender basis, or age basis, by addressing the problem that unemployment is at 24%. If it's around 7%, you'll see a lot of these discriminatory tendencies going away, because you've essentially taken away the power from the employer. They've got nothing to ration. There is nobody queuing for jobs outside of their fence. So it's to address the falling problem of jobs through government policy.
Just to say that, yeah, that's it from us, Jay. If there are no follow-up questions, just to say that, you know, we are based, well, we have a Cape Town office, and anytime you want to speak to us, we are available.
Yeah, now just to, the majority of the questions answered and the manner in which it was responded to generally is completely and fully aligned to national treaty thinking and the way that the budget process also evolves. But just with respect to one question that was raised, where I would like to provide slightly more information, the issue about the sanitation function and the shift between the departments. It's not a national treaty decision. What happened is a number of years ago, the departments were reconfigured. And what happened, the sanitation function was moved from the Department of Water Affairs to the Department of Human Settlements. What that means is that all the staff and everything moved to the Department of Human Settlements. So it's not a decision that national treaty shifted the money. It's a question that the function was actually shifted between departments. And we can't fund the department that's not responsible for the function. And it is one of the things that maybe does infringe service delivery, because the shifts of functions do not happen without challenges in service delivery. So a number of new departments were created, and so it's correct. Again, the placement of sanitation has been controversial, and there are considerations.
Ms. Badham, thank you very much for the answer. However, I think the maybe events have overtaken you. Honored Masuko understands very well what she is asking, because now the issue is that it's also going to be moved away from human settlement to the municipality. So we're going to have a, what you call a, no, don't shake your head. Go and find out your facts first, and then you come back. We're going to have I'm sure we're planning to have a meeting. In fact, the portfolio committee has requested us to have a meeting with yourselves around this, what you call the issue. But you'll get an invite where you can perhaps engage, we can engage fully. But honored members, I think that the time is not on our side now. There's a sitting this afternoon. So there's a sitting this afternoon. But I just want all of us to agree that we will not, what you call, have an opportunity to make follow-up questions. But I think the question that honored members raised from the beginning in terms of the we did, Honorable Matagana at the beginning of the meeting raised the question of the approach on this, what you call it, and you were spot on to say it should not just be a question of compliance. That's what we raised at the beginning on our side, that it shouldn't just be a question of compliance, but say, in future, how do we deal with this report? It's an important report, and maybe we need to find a way ourselves, and we'll come back to FSC, whether we want to deal it chapter by chapter, or want to have, we don't normally have time, or maybe with a 2 days workshop sitting, dealing with FSC, and after which perhaps, but also to say, because of time frames, the year is very short. You know, sometimes portfolio committees, they have this. In fact, there's no, I don't understand sitting here, I'm sure we don't understand. If
you engage with Department of, I mean, Portfolio Committee on Energy or in whatever Portfolio Committee, those recommendations, where do they go? The Money Bills Proceeds and Related Matters Act, it gives this committee the responsibility to take those recommendations, I guess, reporting back to Parliament. Now, the other people, if they have recommendations, it means that we must look at the question of the timing, so that National Treasury can receive our recommendations on time, or the department can receive them on time. But I think that all of us we agree that we need to find a proper way of dealing with it. The 3 hours that we do between 9 and now, it's not sufficient to to engage on these issues. But I don't know, one of members, something that perhaps was not raised here. The other issue that we have dealt with in the past is the issue of expanded public works program. I don't know if you would have that time, but it would have to be a short, what you call a research, to say expanded public works program is underspending, hugely underspending, both at provincial and national level. I think by the end of the year, they spend about 60-something% if they have done well. But the issues that we are confronted with as a committee is, how do we make this grant work? One thing that we have agreed upon with the department and national treasury is to allocate some money upfront to municipalities. It's a very small amount, say 1 million rand upfront. But it's clear that something needs to be done, because it's a lot of money. It's meant to create jobs. The difficulty that one that has not noticed with municipalities is to identify just the projects that they think that so maybe if you could have just time, maybe I'm sure we'll can discuss it outside this, and agree that in the next term, maybe you could come back to us and advise us on what you think that the rest could be done to improve the spending on that grant. On that note, I would like to thank you on behalf of the committee for coming. And I'm sure we'll come back to you about the processes that we have raised about. But honourable members, just two things that one would like to raise. If we want to raise something, comrades, for example? No. I think we're done with them. We thank them for coming. So they must go before we have lunch, so that they can join us for lunch. No, I'm joking. We have no lunch. No, thank you very much. I was going to come to that. Yeah. I thought that you were raising something else.
You're not raising it.
All right, members, we're not going to have another meeting now until we travel to Devon.